this basic pattern of what I call IFD. You hear me all right? There's the wind and the... Shall we leave that open? Huh? You want it open? Okay. Okay. I wanted to protect the people in the hall from my lecture. But it probably will be much more comfortable in here. Tell me if you cannot hear me back there. There's wind today. I regard the pattern which I have put into words on the board, the IFD pattern of behavior, so basic and is illustrating so much about general semantics that I want to develop it some more today and lead in to what we're going to be talking about from now on for several hours. We talked last time about some of the varieties of human handicaps, problems. Now, with regard to basic one as the kind that we call evaluational, it really, I think, tends to be largely true that it isn't what happens to you so much that matters, it's how you take it. It isn't the basic or the physical, tangible facts about you that matter so much as the way you evaluate them. At any rate, what I observe with my own eyes from behind my desk in the clinic, and what I think I observe outside the clinic, what I think anyone can observe if he's alert, can observe in himself and in others, is that what we see when we see trouble, human trouble, tends to be most apparent as demoralization in some form. And the forms that it takes are things like this. People complain when they begin to talk about their troubles. They complain sometimes about physical reactions. They can't sleep, for example. They're tense. They do take tranquilizers. They feel nervous. They feel tense. They also complain very often of being tired, excessively fatigued, run down. There probably is a great appeal to the tired blood advertisement. They're listless. They seem discouraged and apathetic. They're not very busy. They represent a very important distinction we need to make between being tired by what you do on the one hand, and on the other being tired of what you do or what you have to contend with. They're tired of it much more often than they're tired by anything. It's healthy to be tired by what you do. When they talk about how they feel, they talk about discouragement, they may get quite philosophical about this. They may become very sophisticated. They could write a book about the hopelessness of life. And some of them do write such books. They're rather sick books. I think, this is my opinion, when they talk about themselves, What I hear them saying, mostly, in the work I do and in many of the parties I go to, is they talk about their feelings of unacceptability, of inferiority is an overworked word, and I'm afraid that we very often use it rather glibly, and people use it. They talk about feeling guilty in some way of something, for some reason, feeling anxious, concerned, uneasy, afraid. These are rather negative kinds of feelings. They're very fundamental in human trouble. Feelings of dread, regret. The forward and the backward look are both sort of shrinking. They tend to reject themselves. But these feelings are usually mixed, as I hear them expressed, with feelings of resentment, hate, hostility, rejection of others, contempt. And sometimes aggressive self-assertiveness. But the trouble is that this aggressive self-assertiveness and even the expressions, the verbal expressions of resentment and hate and hostility, dislike, because they are so often directed against persons that are important to the people who are expressing these feelings, they merely accentuate, they tend to reinforce the feelings of guilt and anxiety. Having expressed themselves regarding their hatreds and their dislikes and their resentments, they don't feel better. They feel more guilty now, more anxious, and so they have more need to resent. And it's a snake with his tail in his mouth, you know. And it's a thank you. It's a vicious circle type problem. So many problems are, because after all, abstracting, as we will be making a great deal of later, is a self-reflexive process. What you say affects what you say. What you feel affects what you feel. Almost all of our problems tend to be vicious circle problems, and almost all of our good fortune tends to take the form of the benevolent circle or spiral. The better things are. Nothing fails like failure. Nothing succeeds like success. These sound like cliches, but they are really, I think, laws. And so you get this exaggeration of all these undesirable feelings, reactions, until in the worst forms that trouble takes, the kind of trouble we're talking about, it becomes despair, a sort of a profound apathy, a settling down to a smolder of disappointment and dread and regret and discouragement and self-belittlement. Now, that's a pretty dismal picture. Of course, you see it in various degrees and shades of dark blue and lighter blue. But I think this is on the level of abstraction on which I am talking. This is a fairly dependable picture, as I personally have it to report, of observations of human beings in distress, in quandaries. These are people in quandaries. Now, I want to focus on the semantic aspects of all this, the language aspects of it, if you like, on the importance that this tends to make apparent of what you tell yourself. One of the observations to be made immediately is that if you listen long enough to people in trouble talking about their troubles, their quandaries, and if you listen long enough to the people who attempt to be helpful to them, to understand them, you must conclude that we have a language that is very, very rich for talking about demoralization, for talking about despair and maladjustment and illness and trouble. We have a very rich language for this. And it's becoming richer all the time. We are making finer and finer distinctions in talking about distress, illness, abnormality, maladjustment. And on the other hand, we seem to have a very sparse language, a vocabulary, for talking about wellness, for talking about good adjustment, contentment, constructive creativity. I want to emphasize this. You can get into situations where you hardly ever hear anybody talking about these things. I told you the other day about my friend Dr. Dunn, who has become very much preoccupied with what he calls wellness. I saw him last night. He was here in town for a meeting. Delightful fellow. And he just published a book. I have the book with me one day, entitled High Level Wellness by Halbert Dunn. I think you ought to write it down. This is a wonderful idea. High Level Wellness, the name of it, paperback book, and I forget the publisher, but Iowa Supply can always tell you who the publisher is. The author is Dunn, D-U-N-N. We were talking about this a bit last night. I was reminded again. There's a hazard in going to a clinic, a hospital, because you do find yourself there in a semantic environment where the emphasis is upon what's wrong with you. You can learn the language of Freud, the Freudian language. And when you've learned it, you find that you cannot say anything nice about anybody with it. And this is terribly important. It isn't just a little funny. It's a little sad. It's a little dangerous. There's a hazard to couch travel. It's a dangerous vehicle, the couch, the psychoanalytic couch. You can get hurt on it. Because the language which you will be subjected to on this ride is a language which will emphasize for you the things about you that are undesirable. And you can use this language in talking about yourself so long that you make yourself sicker and sicker. If you don't have a language for talking about this language, if you're going to use languages like this, you have a very great need for meta-language that will enable you to avoid the depressing effect, the demoralizing effect of such languages. There is a need in clinics, in schools, and homes for a kind of the semantic sanitation and asepsis. In schools, there is a great tendency, the language in schools, the language which is used to react negatively to what children do and to what students do, is much more highly developed than the language which is used to react positively to what they do. I wish someone would get interested. There's so much work to be done. We need some very careful research on this. We simply need to record the language of the classroom, the interchange between teachers and pupils, and make a determination of the relative amounts of negative and positive evaluation expressed by teachers in talking to children. Teachers obviously will differ in this. But there is a tremendous emphasis upon the negative. Before you do the study, if you have been at all observant, you're aware of this. Most teachers seem to fancy that it's their function in life to tell people what they've done wrong. And we know enough about learning to know that you tend to learn to do the things, the responses, which get reinforced. And it just is rather bizarre that we do not apply this fundamental information we have so well established about learning in trying to help children learn. Now, the same thing is true in homes. We need to plant some tape recorders around in American homes and find out what goes on verbally between parents and children. From the vantage point I have, and it could be biased because I work in a clinic, but biased or not, and this should be allowed for, I would suspect that one would find that there is a lot more of the don't kind of language and the no kind of language, and there is the yes and the less do kind of language in homes. There's much more verbal restraint than there is verbal facilitation. But again, I wish someone who has the time for it, who isn't doing too much else, would take this on and get a grant and get some tape recorders in some homes and find out what's happening. Because I think that what is happening is rather depressing. And we could do something about it if we only knew that it was there. Now, the point is that we tend to react to these negative verbal kinds of stimuli that we encounter from our teachers and our parents and our other authority figures. We tend to react in two main ways that are undesirable. The one is by avoiding the situations where these things occur. And so children drop out of school. And they leave home, not physically so often, as evaluationally or emotionally. They leave home. They're there, but they're not there. They're not really paying attention. They're not really engaged in a constructive relationship with the family. Because they're avoiding these unpleasant verbal responses that their behavior tends to elicit. They not only drop out of school, they tend to avoid certain courses. Almost everybody tries to avoid math, where it is especially easy for the teacher to point out mistakes. Because, you see, you work problems and you get wrong answers, and it's a very easy way to teach math to check all the wrong answers. We tend to react to this by not taking math anymore, and we have to. Leaving it is also unpleasant. Seems perfectly obvious. It's amazing to me that this goes on year after year. Anybody who can read a page can find out in 2 hours in any psychology textbook that this would be just about the most effective technique you could possibly devise to drive people away from math. And that if you want them to like math and to be interested in it and to want more of it, then you wouldn't do this. You would concentrate on what they do right. I'm personally delighted with the advent of the teaching machine. I think it is one of the great hopes of American education or world education, if judiciously used. And one way to use it judiciously, the teaching machine, is to program the teaching of mathematics and eliminate this teacher who is a source of constant punishment. One of the nice things about teaching math by machine is that you eliminate this increasingly hostile relationship between the pupil and the teacher. And the programming is done ordinarily in such a way as to ensure that the student will get the right answer about 90 to 95% of the time. So he's almost always right. And the effect is that it's sort of like eating popcorn. You can't wait to do the next problem. And the fact is, from the studies that have been done, teaching math by machine, that students learn a given amount of algebra, mathematics of any kind, in about half the time, and they end up liking it. This is marvelous. This is just wonderful. This is one of the greatest things that has happened in education, I think. I from all I have been able to learn about this, I have concluded, until I learn something more that will make me change my mind, that whatever you can teach by machine, you can teach better by machine than you can with a live teacher. For this very reason that I am not talking about, you eliminate the negative reinforcement that teacher provides by her bungling way of concentrating on what's wrong. The machine tends to concentrate on positive reinforcement. The programming is so done as to ensure positive reinforcement. And this is the difference. And it's a tremendous difference. I think the same thing could be done to teach English composition and spelling and all these other things that are taught by tallying up all the mistakes every day. Children tend to drop out of those courses, or if necessary, drop out of school. The other way we react to this kind of negative reinforcement is to reject it. And that we tend to do this according to a certain kind of formulation. It's as though there were two kinds of things that are said to us by people who evaluate us. Two kinds, good and bad. The one we call criticism. and then everything else that is not criticism. Or the way we tend to everything that is not praise, we tend to classify as criticism. And we learn to resent criticism. And this very effectively blocks us out from a very large proportion of the help we could get from others who have something to tell us that we could use to improve what we do, or what we think, or what we know. Because we learn very early to react to the negative reinforcement of our teachers and parents, to classify what they're doing to us, what they're saying to us, as criticism. And we learn very rapidly not to like it. And we resent criticism. And the baby that we tend to throw out with the bath is an enormous and beautiful baby. We need this baby. We need criticism. We need instruction. We need evaluation. We need help in trying to improve and to grow and to realize our potentials. I just think that one of the greatest disabilities that there is in the world is the epidemic resentment of criticism. If you want to so bring up your own child that he will just forge ahead and be tremendously productive and learn and realize himself most easily and to the greatest extent, teach him to welcome criticism, to go hunting for it, to pay for it, to want it, use it. And you can do this, I'm sure. And you can do it yourself, to yourself, starting now. Now that you know this, or you knew it all the time. But it takes a little thinking about it, I guess. These reactions that I'm talking about, and that you see in the clinic, and I think in schools, and I think in society generally, they amount to blockages. Blockages to learning, blockages to personal growth, blockages to time binding, blockages to self-realization. Now, the problem of reducing this sort of thing, these blockages and the demoralization which colors this kind of reaction, which is associated with it, I think can be attacked in something like this. It seems to me quite obvious, as you get to know people with the kinds of problems I've been trying to describe, seems to me quite obvious that they have a great need for hope, hopefulness, enthusiasm. Does this sound commonplace and obvious? They often seem to need to have a sense of purpose, of direction. They need ideals of a kind, because they tend to have rejected the ones they have. They haven't worked out for them. They have been frustrated trying to achieve them. And as they become sufficiently demoralized, they tend to reject. They have no effective ideals. This is one thing that you feel. I ask often in the clinic a couple questions that I think tend to bring out very, very revealing answers. They sound rather innocent. One of them is, what do you want to be doing 20 years from now? It's, I think, one of the very best projective tests I know. And what it so often tends to reveal is just no sense of direction, no purpose, no significant desires. I think it's a joke, but one of my friends said that he has a grandson, a little boy, and he asked him what he wanted to be when he got big, and he said that he wanted to be a retired businessman. And he didn't care what kind of a business it was either. Well, coming from a four-year-old, that sounds funny, and somebody probably taught it to him, I don't know. But coming from an 18-year-old, it sounds very sad. The other question that I sometimes ask, and to which I think I get rather significant answers, is what if you were to wake up in the morning and your difficulties would all be gone? What would you do? What would you do before noon? And again, the answers you get tend often to be rather depressing. It's a kind of a blah answer. Now, what is there to do before noon? It's very obvious that these people do need purpose and direction and ideals and ambitions. They've had them knocked out of them by their idealism of a kind that hasn't been too good. I think that hasn't been realistic, or that they haven't been taught or learned without being taught to evaluate their ideals in a realistic way, even if they are not realistic ideals. And I think you follow me. You can have ideals that you can never achieve, but if you don't intend to, that's all right. So they give you some kind of a sense of direction. These individuals seem to have a great need because they have rejected themselves. They feel guilty, they feel unworthy and not up to it. They need more self-acceptance. This takes a little defining. The best way I know to tell you about it is to tell you the way it was put once by a friend of mine who's a doctor, pediatrician. And he had been reading some of the things that I had published about the stuttering problem. And he said that what he got out of this was this kind of an approach to adults, because he was a pediatrician, but he got interested in adults. He was very much interested, as I think any good practitioner who works with children ought to be. You ought to be interested in the adults are going to become. And too often, it just seems to me that we have children programs with no appropriate sense of what we're trying to make out of these kids. Well, he was very much interested in adults because he was a pediatrician. And he said that he often found himself telling adults that, you see, in this, the work we've done, one of the implications of the findings is that parents ought to accept the best speech the child is capable of and don't react negatively to this. Don't classify it as abnormal or don't call it stuttering or think of it as stuttering. It's what the child is doing. Respond positively to it. Make speaking rewarding. Don't make it an ordeal. Accept it. And if he isn't talking well, well, look around him. Find out what is he responding to. Probably you. And so Dr. Misseldine said that he found him telling adults, look, why don't you react to yourself as though you were two people? You are yourself now. You're an adult. And you're also yourself as you were when you were a child. Now, he said, it isn't just that you were a child. You still are. But you're an adult, too. So picture yourself with yourself on your back, carrying yourself piggyback. Here you are, yourself, you're an adult, and and piggyback, you have yourself as a child on your shoulders. Now be good to him. Be good to him. Accept him. That's you when you were, and you are yet. Now, you may be disappointed in some of the things that kid does, or used to do, but you accept him. And through accepting him, you accept yourself now. It's good for you to accept the child you used to be. Just as it's good for the parents to be understanding of their children. It's probably almost better for the parents than it is for the children. I often think that the work I do with kids may or may not help the kids, but it's awfully good for the parents, because they're having to do things that are good for the children. It's good for people to be good to people. That's the law. The people who are being the most damaged in Mississippi are the whites. It's probably even kind of ennobling for the Negroes to have to learn to live with such things. But it's very degrading for those who inflict this on other people. Did I ever tell you about a very dramatic moment in the White House conference of 1950? This is a big conference. These were started by Teddy Roosevelt when he was president. Every 10 years, some 4,000 or 5,000 American citizens from all walks of life are appointed to go to Washington and have a conference. It's called the White House Conference on Children and Youth. In 1950, we were meeting out in the old armory in Washington. It's an enormous building. And there were about 5,000 of us. And we had microphones around the floor. And this was before the 1954 Supreme Court decision about desegregation. And so this is a kind of conference where you pass resolutions. And the resolutions are read by people who have to do with legislation and whatnot, and they probably have a great effect. They have had these White House conference resolutions have led to some things like the establishment of the Children's Bureau and many other things. And we were debating a resolution about desegregation, and of course there were people there from all over the country, and so it was a divided vote. And people were going to the microphones to speak their minds. And in the midst of this, there came over the loudspeaker from one of the microphones on the floor, a very rich southern dialect. It was the voice of a white man. And he was saying, "I am opposed to segregation because of the great harm that it does to the white to children of the South." And you can imagine the reaction. And never was anybody more right. The reason, for instance, that we need to have programs in our schools for handicapped children isn't just for the handicapped children. I just think, personally, it's impossible to have any kind of proper character education in a school where the children see their elders neglecting handicapped children. You have programs for handicapped children, for the normal children, so they can get some decent character education. It's very bad for the normal children, for the handicapped children, to be neglected. Well, this all applies to each one of us. It's very bad for you to reject yourself. It hurts you more than it hurts you. There being many of you. And it hurts your more mature self, or potentially mature self, more than it hurts your childhood self, which, after all, is history. These people need to learn how to talk about themselves using dates. We'll come to this later in the course, dating and indexing, and I don't mean dating of the kind you mean. I mean being oriented in time in a certain way, so that you don't talk about yourself. I can't accurately talk about what I did when I was 5 years old. I today never was 5 years old. That was another Wendell Johnson, who was 5 years old. I doesn't mean that unless I put a date on it. I, age five. That's a very different person from me today. And it simply represents confusion for me to go around with the feelings of I, 5 years old. And this is part of the mechanism for self-acceptance, self-understanding. You are a dated. You are a dated serial. You are a dated sequence. You are not what you were. One of the most powerful instruments I know to counteract this demoralization I'm talking about is the mirror. People who feel bad are usually will almost always be found to be feeling bad about something other than what is immediately at hand. They're feeling bad about a memory, or on the basis of a memory about which they feel bad, they're dreading some anticipation. And if only they can learn to look at themselves literally and ask themselves, well, how is it? Take a look at your feet. They're all right? They're all right. Hands all right? They're all right. What's wrong? Nothing's wrong, except what I remember. Learn to use a mirror to face the here and now, because that's what you have to deal with. It's terribly important. Put a date on what it is that you are reacting to. People with this kind of demoralization problem need, I think, very much to reform their language, revise their language in one particular way, especially. Or I suppose if you wanted to make the most general statement about the kind of reform needed, they need to learn to talk about what is important to them, to talk about it more descriptively. But that's a little vague, perhaps, to you. If you listen to them, you hear them using two kinds of words very, very much. Is, or am, are, to be, and have. I have a tendency. I am the type. I am a such and such. I am a stutter. I am inferior. I am neurotic. I have an anxiety. Now, the trouble with this language is, you see, what you tell yourself has a very great effect on what you do. It is an enormous mechanism of self-stimulation which operates constantly, every minute of the day. and all night. And it seems to me rather ridiculous even to argue about whether this would have any effect. And with this kind of language, you are constantly telling yourself that you are something that is not good and you have something that is undesirable. Now, the implication is, what is almost an unspoken assumption here is, that it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to do anything about what you are or what you have. This is hopeless. I can't help what I am. I can't help what I have. I am what I am. And this is hopeless. This is a paralyzing kind of verbal self-stimulation. And what such an individual needs is a language in which the word that recurs and recurs and recurs is do in some form. That is, I'm using do as a very generic, as a generic term to cover a very, very broad category of terms, all of them being descriptive of what you do. Because this not only focuses your attention all day long, if you use this kind of language, upon what you do, and where you do it, and when, and with what effects, on the realities of the situation you're dealing with, but it is so obvious that you can't overlook it that you can change what you do. And this is very hopeful. These people need hopefulness. And it isn't enough to tell them to be hopeful. They need to know how to be hopeful, and this is how you be hopeful. Talk about something you can do something about. And you can do something about what you do. You can't do anything about what you are and what you have.